Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person.
It's a symbol.
An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
If nothing else, this last year was one of adaptation. To adapt and grow and evolve, this is where the Great Courses Plus comes in. I've done a lot of writing in my life, and I've wanted to continue to grow that aspect of my life, whether it's emails or social media messages or whatever. Renowned writing instructor Dr. Allison Friedrichs has a series at the Great Courses Plus. It's called Written Communications, Being Heard and Understood. Some of this gets into the minefield of grammar and syntax, but the best part for me talks about how language builds relationships. To write in a way that gives voice to your voice, right? It's amazing. It's so useful. The Great Courses Plus has thousands of lectures like these, everything from doing your finances to astronomy to learning how to play an instrument. Ready anytime on any device and, of course, downloadable via the Great Courses Plus app. How will you grow this year? Sign up for the Great Courses Plus and find out. Visit my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. You will get 14 days of unlimited access for free. You don't want to pass this up. So go now to thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. My guest today is friend and fellow activist, Noah Lusions. He is perhaps best known as host and producer of the Scathing Atheist podcast. He also co-hosts God Awful Movies with Eli Bosnick and Heath Enright. It's a great show where they take these really cheeseball religious films and review them on the podcast. And he's got his fingers and I don't know how many pies. He's spoken all around the world. He's written a couple of books previously, Diatribes, Volume 1 and 2, and he's got a new book out called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. Before we talk about the book, I got to talk about one of the most heartwarming rescue stories in the history of all rescue stories. How are the cats doing? Like, let's do the important stuff first. How are the kitties?
Well, obviously. Peekaboo and Binky, they've been with me for almost a year and a half now. They were born under a vacant house next door to me. Slowly, my wife and I coaxed them in. They've been living on with us, like I said, for about a year and a half now. I wake up every morning with the two of them laying between my legs, and they're pretty happy to be alive. They're starting to get fat and chunky.
So I was going to ask, are they the snuggle in your lap kind of cats? Or are they the sit on the counter and plot your demise kind of cats?
Well, I don't think those are mutually exclusive. There's some overlap on that Venn diagram. No, they are the sweetest things in the world. Though we already had two cats, and the older cats, you know, didn't take super well to the idea of a couple new kittens, but they're getting used to it now.
Noah Lusions is one of my favorite people in quote unquote the movement. He is one of those guys who's refreshingly honest, and he has a really sharp wit about him, but he's also kind and really cares. And I think that's sort of the temperature of the new book. Now, did you co-author it with attorney Andrew Torres of Opening Arguments, or did he write just the foreword? How involved was he?
Well, so it was a team effort, actually, between him, myself, and my two co-hosts, Heath Enright and Eli Bosnick. I actually wrote the book. Andrew just wrote the foreword, but everybody had input on what we were trying to say, what examples we wanted to use, what style and what voice we wanted to use. It really was a collaborative effort from the beginning. In fact, it was Eli and Heath that outlined the book before I ever set finger to key.
The book is called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. Explain the title.
So the goal with the title was obviously to communicate what the book's about, but to also sort of take a step back from how serious a subject it was. We wanted people to know that while we're dealing with a serious subject and while we have a very serious point to make, it's not going to be a book that you can't laugh at. We wanted to make the title at least lighthearted enough to tell people that it's okay to giggle at this subject here and there, despite how dire it is.
You talk in the book about how like 3/4 of American citizens profess some flavor of Christianity, and yet a much larger percentage don't actually participate in the religion. I think Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, used to call this belief in belief. Is that what you'd call it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Belief in belief. Like, do you think it's like a lapel pin that makes them feel superior? I mean, I guess it's probably not a binary answer. What's your perspective on belief in the United States?
Well, more and more, it's becoming less of a lapel pin and more of a get out of jail free card. The thing that people are clinging to at this point with Christianity is all the perks. We've got a Supreme Court that seems bound and determined to give them more rights than everyone else, to give them a right to discriminate that no one else has or should have, to give them the rights to ignore COVID restrictions that no one else has or should have. I believe that for a lot of people for a very long time, the reason most Americans were Christian is because it was the easy thing to do. It made you part of a club. It gave you a built-in social circle, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's become more and more defined by its bigotry, by its willingness to accept antiquated modes of thought vis-a-vis other people, vis-a-vis minorities. And I think the Supreme Court is codifying that as quick as they can.
I was asked on many occasions, when do you think we'll get an atheist president? I'm suspecting our answers on this are going to be the same, but I'll let you answer. How would you respond to that? Well, one day, do you think we'll ever have an atheist in the White House? What do you think?
Well, I think we've had plenty of atheists in the White House.
Yeah.
Will we ever have an open atheist in the White House? Look, I never say never, because the history of people saying never looks awfully silly. So who the hell knows? 100 years from now, maybe this country will be a bit more enlightened, and we won't cling to the religion as the same as we do. I very seriously doubt that you or I will ever live to see an atheist in the White House, or an open atheist in the White House, I should say.
With a show with the word atheist in the title, I don't take it in the teeth as much, but people get pissed off when we talk politically. But I'm like, if you are a humanist, they force you to engage.
Yeah, I mean, when Trump was first elected, we had a couple of people, you know, leading up to the election. And it was weird leading up to his election, because none of us really took it all that seriously, the possibility that he would be president. So immediately after his election, we had a bunch of listeners saying, hey, can you talk about something else? You guys have been talking about nothing but Trump here. This isn't a politics podcast. And we actually sat back amongst ourselves and said, hey, you know, we should make an effort to like break out of that. But it became increasingly clear over the years. Hell, it didn't even take years, but it became increasingly clear that there was no way to separate out the one from the other. There was no longer a way to talk about religion in America without also talking about politics, and there was no way to talk about politics without also talking about religion.
This is the history of politics and religion. I mean, you can go back thousands of years, and we see that the two tend to bleed together. Even the 20th century, I know I'd written about the Eisenhower era. And, you know, it was the United States. We were holy against the evil and demonic communist Russia, USSR, China, et cetera. We saw the moral majority, right? They came and really began to tap dance over the state church line back in the 80s during the Reagan era. But I've never seen anything quite like what we're seeing now. No Illusions, your commentary on the evangelicals in the era of Trump?
Well, I think it's a terrifying death rattle, you know, or maybe that's the optimistic way of looking at it. But I think that what's happened is, you know, we're seeing evangelicals lose their power. They're losing their majorities. They're losing their political sway. They're losing their, you know, the reason the Supreme Court is codifying all of these new privileges for religion isn't because we've decided to give religion more privileges. It's because they need to be codified now. As my friend Andrew Torres is fond of pointing out, if you or I decided we were going to give a glass of wine to a 14-year-old girl Sunday morning, we'd get in trouble. But nobody ever bothered to say, you know, it's okay for a priest to do it, because no one had to say that.
So the Supreme Court, with Barrett now entrenched in the highest court in the land, gives favorable treatment to churches in New York. They get a different set of rules. You've been following that story?
Yeah, I mean, I think Joe Biden is too much of a traditionalist to really consider packing the court. I think that's the only real solution. I think we've just moved backwards, and it's going to take another lifetime to get back to where we were in terms of the rights of atheists, of non-religious people, and of religious minorities. My hope is that it won't be as bad for religious minorities as it was in the past, but it's certainly going to be worse for atheists, at least as long as you and I live. I mean, I think, look, when Donald Trump got elected, that was the biggest failure of the atheist and secular and humanist movement of my lifetime.
Do you think there's merit in expanding the court past the current dozen seats?
Absolutely. If the Republicans want to play that game, right, if the Republicans want to play the game of every time somebody else comes in, they expand the court into their majority, at least that would be better than the idea that for especially, you know, consider that until Trump, of course, most presidents would nominate older people to the Supreme Court. So this lifetime appointment, you're talking about 15, 18, 20 years. He's putting people on that could be on for 40 years. Right. So people say, well, if we expand the court, then they'll expand the court. Fine. That's better than what we've got now. What will most likely happen is that they'll expand the court out. You know, if we were to do this, what will most likely happen is there will be no court expansion. But what would happen if we expanded the court? Most likely is that we would expand the court and then we would come to some agreement on where it was and we would legislate that.
Mike Pence has been kind of the invisible man, at least at the time of our conversation here as we're doing that. I mean, he's popped his head out occasionally, but I get the vibe he's just sort of sitting back and kind of trying to stay out of the limelight, perhaps to remain politically viable. Even watching Pence, what's your take on the guy?
Yeah, Pence scares me a lot, and he scared me. I'll admit to my ignorance going into the Trump administration. I was more scared of Pence than Trump because I assumed that Trump would largely be a figurehead that would sit back and watch the news, which turned out to be correct. But I also didn't think he would like so actively stand in the way of the people who were trying to govern. So I assumed that Mike Pence would actually be taking on the bulk of the governance. And in a sense, if you look at, you know, Trump's accomplishments, whatever, you know, for whatever that's worth, you'll find that it's mostly Pence's priorities. So to an extent, that was true. Now, obviously, the real problem with Trump was the tweet flares that were going out every 16 seconds where you were constantly wondering what country we were going to wind up at war with over a Twitter insult. But yeah, I mean, I think Pence has done a phenomenal job moving behind the scenes, getting what he wants, what his people want, you know, which is obviously more rights for religious people to discriminate against LGBTQ people. I think that's his primary focus. But also, of course, he's got that sort of neocon past as well. So yeah, I'm actually shocked at what a good job he's done when you consider what a controversial person he was going into the office, what a good job he's done of remaining untainted or relatively untainted by Trumpism.
I'm interested in Vice President Pence's sort of walk between the raindrops position on gay conversion therapy, these insidious programs where they take LGBTQ people and they bring them in and try to fix them because obviously they're broken. And you talk in the book about how he didn't overtly come out and say, you know, I support gay conversion therapy, but he didn't have to say that. You want to explain it?
Yeah, so there was a big controversy of this about this during the Olympics when or the Winter Olympics when Adam Rippon came out and Pence, I guess, was the leader of some national, whatever the group that we send over diplomatically for the Olympics. He was the leader of it. And there was an openly gay figure skater that says, like, I can't believe that you would expect me to meet with a guy that supported gay conversion therapy, that sought to federally fund it. And there was this big kerfuffle, this big to-do where all of his people, all of his handlers came out and said, oh, no, 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 no. You know, he never did that. It's a matter of public record that he did it. Again, like you say, he didn't say the words gay conversion therapy, but he was fighting to redirect funds that were meant to prevent HIV/AIDS to gay conversion therapy as saying, well, that'll prevent HIV/AIDS right there. I don't have the statement in front of me, but he had this despicable statement about how, you know, how can we treat the outcome without treating the root cause of the problem, where he was very clearly referring to homosexuality.
You brought up the AIDS epidemic. Let's talk about Robert Redfield. 18th director of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's got a spotty record as a quote-unquote scientist. You talk about him in the book.
Yeah, I believe it was Foreign Policy Magazine that when he was nominated said ran the headline, "Come Eat Trump's New Public Health Quack."
Wow.
Right? That's a real encouraging sign for the leader of the CDC. Now, of course, when that happened, we had no idea how important that role was going to be relative to other CDC directors in the past, right? Like, this is the time when we most in the history of America needed a good head of the CDC. And what we got instead was the guy that evangelical Christians like, the guy who had been a virulent homophobe publicly a number of times, the guy who had come out repeatedly against using condoms as a first line of defense against AIDS and HIV spread in Africa. That's who this guy was. He wrote the foreword to an entire book about how distribution of condoms is an evil that promotes promiscuous sex and is an affront to God. That's the man who's, you know, again, him and Mike Pence, the two people ostensibly leading our response to this global pandemic. How the hell could this possibly have gone right?
I was reading through the book, and you profile specific people in point positions in its administration, and I kept saying, shit, he's from Oklahoma. And then the next, oh, shit, he's from Oklahoma. All right, Scott Pruitt, former Oklahoma State Attorney General, director of the EPA for about a year, starting in 2017. Of course, we want somebody who's received major, M-A-J-O-R, major money from the fossil fuel industry to be in charge of environmental protection. The guy's also a hardcore evangelical in a strong field of horrible choices. Why did you single Pruitt out in your book?
Yeah, well, so at the beginning of the book, the big connection that I was trying to make was I was trying to point out that, so one of my big concerns coming out of this pandemic is that many people will look at the pandemic, they'll look at the Trump administration, and they'll say, see, that's what happened right there. We had a big disaster and we had that idiot in charge, and that's the problem. But that's not the problem. That's a symptom of the problem. The problem is that we have so much religious leadership. We have so many religious qualifications for leadership, and that so many people are willing to prioritize religious faith, which again in modern day America basically means, do you hate all the right people, over the ability to actually do the job. And so Scott Pruitt, like you said, could not be less qualified. He was literally getting major infusions of cash to his campaign from the fossil fuel industry when he was running unopposed. Right? That's the guy we're talking about. But like you said, he's got the evangelical bona fides. He's anti-abortion. He's anti-LGBTQ. And that mattered to these people way more than whether or not he had qualifications. Don't get me wrong. For whatever reasons, evangelicals seem to kind of have some antagonism towards Earth itself. They don't seem to be big fans of the environment.
Well, right? A lot of what I see is kind of a Christian dominionist theology. God gave us the land and the resources. It's arrogant for us to think we could ever permanently adversely affect the earth, or it doesn't matter anyway because God's going to come and wipe it out and we're all going to go to heaven. I mean, they've got sort of an out that they have excused. We have dominion and it's temporary, so who gives a shit?
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. It's disposable and it's my disposable. Yeah. But that's just the thing, is that I don't think that the average evangelical Christian actually wants more polluted water or worse air for their children or, you know, more disease or anything. But they're willing to take that if that means that they can get the guy in the position that is anti-abortion, is anti-LGBTQ, is pro-Jesus. And when those qualifications become twisted in that way, there's really no hope for us to have rational responses to disasters.
I've seen that in my own zip code. There are people who would reject Donald Trump in their own lives. They'd never put up with it in a husband, a son, a neighbor, a friend, a spouse, whatever. But because he is on what they consider to be the right side of a single issue, in many cases, usually it's abortion, it becomes a conversation stopper, I think even a thought stopper. Well, he's going to protect life. All other considerations are secondary. As long as he is not out there endorsing what they call the murder of babies. It's interesting, Noah, just a digression. I had a conversation with someone who was talking about how that at the moment that the egg and the sperm get together, there is this moment of conception and a human being is created. And of course, you know, reproductive education is not huge in the church. And I said, well, if you believe in an intelligent designer and you take into account that about half of all fertilized eggs are ejected from the female body without coming to term, that would make God the most prolific abortion doctor in the history of the world. And they kind of looked at, they kind of cocked their head like a dog, like, like they'd never even heard of it before.
Well, you know, what's so frustrating to me is that we all see this as this, you know, as a problem that is intractable, right? Like this will always be a thing, but it hasn't always been a thing. Like you and I are both old enough to remember a time when it wasn't quite the hot button issue that it is now. Right. Like, I mean, just barely. I guess maybe you weren't because you were raised so deeply in the religious world. But like, you know, you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, and it was not this divisive issue. It was largely seen as a Catholic issue.
Even in the diagrams and the propaganda that they would distribute, they would always just show like an almost fully formed baby. You know, and then you got Trump, you know, and he's on the stage in front of the State of the Union. In fact, talking horror stories are coming out of his mouth about the ripping apart of babies in the operating room. And it's a fear culture. Fear is a powerful motivator for the easily frightened.
Yeah, I mean, one of the greatest examples I've ever seen of that, of course, one of the shows that we do is God Awful Movies, where we break down all these old Christian movies, and we talk about the propaganda that's floating inside of them. And there was one called, I believe it was called Unplanned. It's the story of Abby Johnson. Is that her name? The anti-abortion activist that used to work for Planned Parenthood and comes out and tells these ridiculous horror stories that have been repeatedly disproven. And in that movie, there's a scene where we see like an ultrasound of a baby being aborted. And I say baby because it is not a fetus, right? It's a fully formed, like you say, fully formed baby. And it's basically like doing dive rolls to get out of the way of the little vacuum cleaner and stuff. It's fighting, doing karate and stuff, like desperately clinging to the walls. It's such a ridiculous image. And yet that's exactly what, like you said, these people are being sold. This idea that there's just a little baby in there wearing a diaper, clawing at the walls, trying to survive like the girl in Silence of the Lambs down in the well or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, we find that there are trends among how people think. And we find that people who tend to be more easily frightened, they are less exposed to the world, they are more comforted by things like walls and tribal symbols, etc., they tend to lean into MAGA conservatism. You know, it's a simpler world, right? There's good and there's evil, and there's black and there's white, and there's right and there's wrong, and there's God and the devil. Then, as a result, anybody who disagrees with them, if they are on the side of God, the rest of us are the devil. This, of course, explains QAnon and the attraction of these wild conspiracies. Your take on QAnon, no illusions. You've been watching this circus play out?
Oh, wow. You know, the thing is that I've been watching it for so long, though, because I was into all the weird conspiracy theory crap long ago in an embarrassing past when I would have told you I was a Wiccan if you'd asked my religion. And I, like, even up through 9/11, like, I was embracing the conspiracy mindset. And I think it was 9/11 that sort of pushed me over the edge where I was just like, okay, this is way too serious for us to still be playing this silly game. But obviously that wasn't enough of a trigger for a lot of people. And like you said, it appeals to this simplicity of narrative. That's what people want. People don't like, you know, in the real world, there aren't good guys and bad guys. I mean, there are bad people, but everybody's the hero of their own narrative. And, you know, generally speaking, people who are against abortion, like you say, they're not as misogynistic, or they're at least not consciously being misogynistic with it. They are concerned with the lives of unborn babies and the lies they've been told, just in the same way that people who are pro-abortion aren't in favor of aborting as many fetuses as they can, the way that it's often sold in the pro-life side of the, you know, we're not drinking the blood of ground up fetuses or whatever it is that they're accusing us of. So, you know, that nuance is no fun. It's no fun to have an enemy with nuance. You know, it's more fun to have this simplistic, dumbass Saturday morning cartoon narrative of good versus evil.
Back to Oklahoma, Jim Bridenstine. He's another Bible banger out of my state, former state representative. Of course, he should be appointed to head NASA. I'm reminded of when he's a climate change denier. He goes into NASA, took him 4 weeks. of showing him the data, and finally he reversed his position. Oh, you know what? Well, maybe the climate is changing, but, and then he put an asterisk on it. But you spend a little time on old Jim Bridenstine in the book, right?
Yeah, like, it blows me away. And again, the point that I'm trying to make in the book here is that the qualifications for leadership have been perverted, because that's one place where I think virtually all of us just assume we set all the political shit aside and put the smartest person we have in charge of it, right? It's rocket science. It's literally rocket science. You'd like to think, you know, in the same way that you would think that a Christian would go into a surgery and say, well, all that matters to me is that the best heart surgeon is operating on me. I don't care if he voted for Biden. You would think that they would do the same thing with rocket science, and it turns out you'd be wrong on both fronts, most likely.
This brings me to my next point. We're watching the Georgia runoff at the time of our conversation, right? The impending runoff. And so I just came together with a bunch of people, I think maybe even including, I don't know, were you involved in the big cognitive dissonance fundraiser?
Was I involved? We had the record half hour.
Oh, well, excuse me. I came on after opening arguments, and Andrew and Thomas had, I don't know, they came up with some obscene number, and I had to follow that. And, you know, I found myself just bowing in their general direction, you know. But people ask us, like, you know, Warnock is a Democrat, but he's also a pastor. Raphael Warnock, the Reverend, out of Atlanta, Georgia. He's running against Kelly Loeffler. She's a Republican. She's part of Trump cult and generally an awful person. And the stakes are huge because after the November 3rd election, we saw 50 Republicans elected to the Senate, 48 Democrats. And now we have these two in play in Georgia for the runoff. So if you see the two Democratic candidates win, now you've got a 50-50 tie in the Senate, the tie-breaking votes coming down to the VP, which will be Kamala Harris. So all eyes right now on Georgia. And there are some people who see the label pastor in regard to the candidate that we support, right, Reverend Warnock, and they think, what the hell is wrong with you? And I'm just going to let you answer the question. You know, why support a pastor for public office?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that the fact that his opponent is actively trying to involve the state in a lawsuit to overturn the will of the people and appoint a president that the people rejected would be enough. If that wasn't enough, I'd like to think the fact that his opponent is a person who, upon hearing how bad COVID was, sold a bunch of stock rather than telling her constituents. Or his constituents, actually, both of them, Perdue and Loeffler, did that, as it turns out. But look, if I get to choose whoever I want for my senator, I'm probably not going to choose a pastor. If I get to choose from what's available, I'm going to choose the person who seems to most align with humanist values. And in this instance, it happens to be a pastor. Look, if Raphael Warnock decides to get in there and say, well, you know what, I want to make the Bible the state book and I want to give Christians all kinds of due privileges, I'm going to vote his ass out of office. And he knows I'm not just among his constituents, but by the time this is over, I'll have raised over $60,000 for his campaign. We're actually doing a second fundraiser for him and Ossoff in a few days. So I'm not opposed to people being religious. I don't care if people are religious. I'm opposed to them forcing their religion into my government. And there's nothing that I've seen out of Raphael Warnock that suggests that he's going to do that. And beyond that, if he did, he's part of the Democratic caucus, which almost certainly, given its makeup, wouldn't allow for it.
No Illusions, co-author of Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. COVID provides kind of the heart of the book. What's your explanation, do you think, for COVID conspiracies?
So when the Newtown massacre happened, I had a lot of people on my Facebook page who were, you know, those old high school acquaintances that sort of glommed onto you when Facebook was young. And a lot of them are very pro-gun because I went to high school in Georgia. You know, they're very rah-rah pro-gun, gun rights matter more than anything. And obviously, when you see a bunch of kindergartners slain because of the thing that you fought for politically, you have to do one of three things. Either you have to change your position, which is very difficult for people to do. You have to admit to yourself that you think that this thing is more important than the lives of children, than the lives of babies, as we saw there, or you have to fashion a whole new universe for yourself where you have no guilt. Right. And God knows Christians are real good. They've got some practice at fashioning up new universes where they have no guilt. And so that's what we saw. And that's what we're seeing with COVID as well. The reality of it is your guy screwed up, the guy that you voted for and fought for and went to rallies for and everything else. He screwed up. He lied to you repeatedly. He kept saying it was going to go away. It was a non-event. So you can either change your mind, admit that you care more about, you know, whatever it is that you think you're getting out of Trump and you care about the lives of 300,000 Americans and counting, or you have to make up a new reality where you have no guilt.
I'm reminded of that quote, when an honest man is shown that he is wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or he will cease to be honest. In relation to the Supreme Court in New York, do you think churches ought to be prosecuted for holding these super spreader services? I mean, you think we ought to, you know, fine them or worse? What do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In a perfect world, anybody, you know, they would be facing the exact same fines that you and I would be facing if we, you know, decided to set up a giant orgy. You know, you could argue that there's much more merit in a giant orgy, especially if Seth's there. But but look, it's the same thing. It's that, you know, there should be no special bonus laws and privileges and rights for religious folks. So, yeah, I mean, you know, look, if I'm the state AG in Oklahoma and I'm given the opportunity to, maybe I don't because it's just not worth it politically. I'm not going to win the case, et cetera. So, you know, in individual circumstances where individual people are trying to make the decision, it might not be as clear, but just in the abstract, absolutely, they should be fine.
So when they're not holding events between a landscaping shop and a dildo store, we're watching essentially the entire freaking White House coughing COVID on each other. There's this, I don't know if it's sweet justice or, because if they recover from it, then they weaponize and minimize and marginalize and say, well, it was nothing. That's just a couple of days. I lost my sense of taste and smell. Don't worry about it, people. So it's actually, I mean, it's not a good thing, but I did find a little bit of Schadenfreude at the beginning when Giuliani and McEnany and every, you know, everybody else is getting it, Trump gets it. Did you feel any of that? What's your take?
I felt the same, but I tempered it with exactly what you're talking about, that fear that, you know, boy, I'll tell you what, if they recover from it, that just makes it all the worse. And of course, they have the top-notch medical care that the average American lacks. So, you know, odds are very much in favor of them recovering.
Ours is a culture primed for conspiracy and apocalyptic thinking, right? And people often ask me, well, why does it matter if people hold religious belief personally? You know, if they want to believe in magic, that's a personal choice. And my thinking is that if they are already primed from their earliest years or whenever to believe the unbelievable, then they go out and participate in society. It makes life harder for everybody.
Absolutely. I think you said it exactly right when you were talking about Michael Cohen's book. You know, Donald Trump is a guy who doesn't have any respect for or belief in any religion. As much as I hate to claim him, I guarantee you that he's, as I say in the book, he's an atheist to the extent that he himself is not a god. So when you present something that's untrue like that, you just leave it laying around. Anybody who has a low enough bar of morality can pick that up and do some terrible shit with it. I'm sure you've joked about it before. I joke about it all the time about how, like, hey, look, if I was really as bad as these Christians think, I'd pretend to believe in their shit and take 10% of their money.
You know, if you and I publicly recanted and said we'd found Jesus, we'd be on the circuit tomorrow, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, if we were unscrupulous, we could probably cash in. But back to the book, you know, it's kind of an interesting challenge when you're writing a topical book at a time when headlines are changing by the second. You type a sentence, something happens, you go back and retype it, something happens, you go back and retype it. There's never really a good time to release it.
No, you know, we had, look, when I first sat down to start writing this, I assumed, as I think many of us did, that we were looking at a 2 or 3 month really weird period where we were going to be in these semi-lockdowns and everything, and then we were going to emerge from it and rub this sun out of our eyes and look on a whole new world and think, well, what the hell just happened, right? So when I started writing it, I assumed that the COVID, or at least that the, you know, that one large spike would be behind us and possibly a second spike in the future, right? I didn't expect for a second that we would just continue to be at that rate of infection all year. As much as I hate to admit it, my imagination couldn't even move to a place that dire.
Who was it who said that it's a bizarre thing where MAGA Americans say that they're unafraid, so they'll go out without a mask, but they have to carry a gun to Starbucks. Like, I don't get
right.
that. 309, hi. Thanks for waiting. Who's this?
This is Jacob Seth.
Hi, Jacob. You're on with No Illusions. Comment or question?
I agreed with your joke. If you guys were to recant and everything, you could make tons of money.
I wonder what we'd name the church. Could we start a religion? Like a fresh religion? Noah, you said you actually hypothesized what a religion might look like.
Yeah, well, so when I was a younger man, gave up the ghost quite literally and became an atheist. Boy, that's a great term for becoming an atheist, isn't it?
Yeah.
At that point, I had started to construct what I called pangeantheism, which was this effort to take all the universal aspects of religion and meld them together into one religion. It's like the hippiest thing you could imagine. What I eventually found was that there were no universals in religion, and so the whole project fell apart and also became a really interesting inroad to atheisms, because I was able to say to myself, essentially, wow, there's not a single thing I can find that all the religions agree on. Not one thing.
So I will make you this guarantee, though. If we start a religion and you give us your tithe, we will ensure you are blessed in the afterlife. I mean, you're not going to get it till after you're dead, but I'll just make that guarantee right here.
I'm fine with that. You know.
All right. Well, may
nothing wrong with that.
May the Lord bless you and keep you. And thanks for calling. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Interesting to watch the God who is not the author of confusion, who is behind a religion that has thousands of disagreeing denominations all fighting with each other. I think we should have Thunderdome and just invite the apologists.
That'd be nice. You know, to the extent that we'll ever disprove religion, I think that's how we're going to do it, right? Like, the idea is basically, if there's a truth value to a system, everyone who studies the system moves towards that same thing, right? Like, when we first, like, we're trying to figure out how the universe worked, how the planets orbited, what they were doing, which directions they were going, everyone had their own theories, everybody had a pet theory, but because it was based on something with a truth value, eventually we zeroed in on the truth. And now, with the exception of the millions and millions of people who think the earth is flat or that the sun orbits around it, we've all agreed. But like, everybody who studies it has agreed on one singular model. Religion follows the model of language, right? Where the more people who speak it, the more different variations you get, the more diversity you get. That's something that doesn't follow a truth value. There's no actual correct word for tree, right? It's all arbitrarily assigned. And so you can look at that trend and I think ultimately prove religion is false that way. At least to the extent that you can prove a negative.
Dr. Loftus, John Loftus, calls this the outsider test for faith, or at least a version of that is, you know, if you want to know what's wrong with this church, you can look at the other churches and their criticisms, right?
Right.
One set of standards for you, a different set of standards for me. Short break. I'll be back with more featuring my heathen author friend, No Illusions. More of your phone calls, and I'm going to read a section from Noah's new book called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith. Hang on. My patrons get this broadcast totally commercial-free, and they get it a couple of days early. Thanks so much for your support at patreon.com/SethAndrews. My guest today is Noah Illusions. He is well known from the Scathing Atheist podcast, from god-awful movies. He's got a brand new book called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. And we've got some callers with comments and questions for the author. 251, hi, you're on with No Illusions. Who's this?
Hello, I'm calling from Mobile, Alabama. My name is Tony Pollutin.
Tony, talk to me. Comment or question for Noah?
Well, I just have a question because, you know, I'm a fellow atheist, but see, I think these court cases for religious gatherings are important for assembly. When they can deny these religious gatherings assembly, later they can deny us our atheist gatherings for assembly. I just think assembly is such an issue. And I'll hang up now and let y'all comment on that. I'm listening to your program late. I've heard the first of it, and I know y'all are further along.
I'll let Noah tackle it first. Thanks for calling.
I think that's a really great point, Tony, except that that's not what we're talking about, right? Our right to assemble has already been restricted. So we're not talking about the abstract right to assemble. That's already been stripped away for the purposes of saving lives during a pandemic. So the slippery slope argument that you're making doesn't follow because we're talking about a rule that is only extant for religious people, an exception that is only being made for religious people. Now, if your argument is that all COVID restrictions should be lifted because of the importance of the right to assemble, I just disagree with you from a public health standpoint.
From your perspective, totally subjective opinion, no illusions. If Jesus was here today, do you think he would look at his followers and say, hey, put on a freaking mask? I mean, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, depends on the Jesus we're talking about. If you're talking about the Jesus from the Bible, no. No. He would say, well, stop washing your hands like a bunch of assholes. Did God not make within that which is without, or whatever the hell his quote is there, right? He would say, what, you don't trust my father to not give you a disease? No, the Jesus of the Bible would have been an anti-masker play rat-licking bastard, I would think.
The old rat-licking Jesus. There's an image I will never get out of my head. No, I'm still trying to picture you as like a religious guy. I mean, were you like hardcore?
Oh, no, no. I was religious to the extent that I thought that it would convince women to take their clothes off. I'm sorry to admit my sexist nature, but if you study Wicca, if you study like those hippie witchcraft neo-pagan religions, there's a lot of sex in them. So you hand that to a 15-year-old boy, you hand him that or the Bible and all the church girls in Georgia, and it's just like, yeah, this is a no-brainer. But I don't think I ever believed in it. Or, you know, maybe that's just a fiction I tell myself so I could be less embarrassed by my younger attitudes, but I don't know that I ever really believed it.
I've had you for an hour, my friend. Are you good for time? Do you have time for a few more calls?
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I don't want to. I know you're juggling. I don't know how much content you people create, you and your team, but good God, I don't know how you do. I have one show, and I feel overwhelmed. I don't know how you guys keep up with as many shows.
Yeah, but you don't have two talented co-hosts the way I do. That helps a ton.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are talented, no doubt. 717, hi. Thanks for waiting. Who's this?
Hi, my name is John, calling from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and you kind of ruined my question there, Noah, because I was just about to ask, like, what was your, like, whole experience with moving away from being religious to where you are today?
I think that's still a relevant question. I mean, how did you escape?
Unfortunately, like most atheists, my trip away from belief was just a sort of gradual taking it less and less seriously. I didn't have any major ties to break the way that Seth did. I think that what was really interesting for me, the only time it ever felt like I'd made a break, is when I would go back 10, 12, 15 years later and see a friend I hadn't seen in a long time, and they were still into all the woo and the neo-pagan witchcraft conspiracy theory crap and expected me to play along. You know, it really felt like there had been a big break for me at that point. But there was certainly no eureka moment.
A lot of people who have that fire in their belly as an activist, though, it's informed by, you know, religion screwed me over. You're really on the front lines. You're an activist guy, but you don't have that backstory.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I'm just an angry dude. I think I was just looking for the right target for my anger. No, I could tell you the moment that I was inspired to be an activist, it still lives in my mind. It occupies a very big space on my mind. I was on a subway train in New York City, and I was watching a Jewish family, a Hasidic Jewish family. I was watching a father berate his daughter for reading this book. It was a boy book, and she wasn't supposed to read boy books. And I didn't understand what was going on. I talked to a Jewish friend of mine afterwards, and he explained to me that that was a thing, that that girls were not allowed to read, or that what they were allowed to read was very restricted in these households. And I says, like, all right, well, I'm absolutely disgusted by that. Does that make me a Nazi? And he goes, no, it just makes you a rational human being. I'm like, okay. And then I got off the train. I walked up, you know, I'm walking away from that conversation. I'd had that conversation with him on the phone. As I'm walking away from it, I see one of the signs that I can't remember what group it was that put these up on the buses that said, good without God. This was during that campaign in New York. I saw that sign and I thought, holy shit, that's what the world needs. The world really does need people who are as angry as I am right now taking religion to task for that. And that, I think, is more than anything the moment that made an activist of me.
But with your upbringing and such, like with your choice to move away from religion, did you fall out with your immediate family at all?
No, I don't think so. My family wasn't particularly religious. My family, my parents got a little more religious after I had left home. But, you know, they were the kind of Christians that when you asked them questions, they would use heaven and Jesus as answers, but they never took us to church.
I appreciate the call, my friend. Thanks for calling.
No problem. Thank you very much for putting me on. You guys have a good day.
You bet. 504. Thanks for waiting. Who's this?
My name is Wade. Right now, we're in the last days of hell, and Giuliani's back for his melting and farting. And I just wonder, is there any hope that Trump will fade away or possibly go to jail?
As much as I'd love, I cannot imagine a world where he winds up in jail. Right. Like I don't doubt for a second that he deserves it, that we'll have all the evidence we need of the crimes that he's committed. I just cannot imagine that universe. I'd like to be wrong on it, honestly, but I just can't imagine that universe. But I think we're going to get the next best thing. I know a lot of people are really terrified of ex-President Trump and what kind of mess he's going to make. But honestly, once you take him out of power, he's just going to be increasingly pathetic. His family is a bunch of ridiculous screw-ups and idiots. I honestly believe that the Republican Party cannot move away from him fast enough. They'll do everything in their power to delegitimize him once he's out of power. His supporters don't like no loser. Right. And he is increasingly just an embarrassing loser. So I honestly think we're going to get to watch this amazing, sad degeneration for like 6 years, and then he'll disappear because he'll be too weak to move, and then he'll die. That's what I think we'll get. And it's honestly, that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
That answer your question, my friend?
Oh, I hope so. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Wade.
So this brings us to just some conjecture. He can't not be in the spotlight. So is it post, like, I'm still president, even though I'm not president rallies? Does he start his own TV network? Does he start a church? He's going to do something, right?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I think the plan originally was to start a TV network, right? Like, he was supposed to lose the election and then start a whole TV network about how Hillary wasn't the legitimate president or what have you. So that might still be in the cards. I don't know. I will say this, whatever it is, it's Donald Trump, so you can count on it being a ridiculous, miserable failure.
I'm tired of talking about him, though. I mean, how much longer do we have to put up? At least if he's not in the highest office in the land, he's easier to just sort of ignore. I'm waiting for Twitter, who, by the way, just sent their new terms of service to be enforced starting January 22nd, 2021, where they have tightened their terms of service. And a lot of people think that Donald Trump's going to get banned from Twitter just as soon as he's ousted from office. I love the idea.
Yeah, as do I. Look, it seems to a lot of people like Trump has a death strangle on the GOP that will never, you know, that'll never let loose and everything. I just want to remind you that there was a time when Rudy Giuliani seemed like an unassailably strong politician, right? There was a time when it was hard to imagine any Republican ever admitting that George W. Bush made a mistake at any point in his career, right? It's all everything seems permanent when you're living in it, but it's all temporary.
216. Hi, you're on with No Illusions. Who's this?
Hi, Seth and Noah. This is Justin from Columbus, Ohio.
What do you think? Comment or question?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment and say, I'm really glad to hear about Noah's book, because the whole issue of religion kind of mitigating our response as a country, I think that's something that people really aren't talking about enough. I mean, I understand why. Obviously, we're basically a, you know, a pseudo-Christian nationalist country at this point. But yeah, like, for example, most of my family, I live in Ohio, most of my family are like God and country, Trump Republican type people. But me, my mother, and my grandma are, you know, a little bit more into science. Like, my brother is QAnon adjacent. He thinks COVID is a hoax. None of it's real. Like, drank off a friend who was concerned they had it, as, you know, to prove that it's not real, stuff like that.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, as Thanksgiving kind of rolled around, and obviously, like most people, we decided not to have a big get-together. And somehow I ended up basically being like the liaison between the members of the family that think that's kind of bullshit and that we should ask something. And then the other members of my family that are thinking, no, obviously this makes sense. And it's so frustrating not just be like, no, you just say, no, we'll say a prayer. We'll go to church. That's not good enough. Like, that's not enough to protect you. And it's not just about you, because you making bad decisions affects everyone else. And it's just so frustrating trying to like reason with people like that. So I just want to say I'm looking forward to the book. Hope to read a lot more about it, and just wanted to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, man, that's a shitty place to be. My wife has been in the same place, right? So my family is generally speaking 99%, I think, pretty much all on board with, no, you know, we're going to be sensible. Normally we go to my side of the family for Thanksgiving, and we do it in either Texas or Illinois, right? And everybody flies in from 19 different places. And this year we were like, obviously we're not going to do that. My wife's family, though, is a lot more on the side that you're talking about of like, no, this is all a hoax. It's not that big a deal. And they have guilted her relentlessly since Thanksgiving for us not having been there. So I feel for you. I don't know what the solution to that is, but I certainly feel for you there.
My grandma, she's the one that usually hosts all the big family get-togethers, and she's in her late 70s, and I have younger my cousins and whatnot saying things to her, and I'm like, what is wrong with you? Like, I don't care what you believe. If she decides for her own safety and for everyone she doesn't want to do this, why would you like pick a fight about that and try to tell her, no, you're wrong in what you believe. You've been brainwashed. This is so frustrating. Yeah, I don't know what the solution is, but it's good to know that at least there's other people that are of the same mentality. So thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. It's like Stephen Hassan, the cult expert. He was saying that, you know, one way that you'll never talk somebody out of a cult is to look them in the eye and say, you're part of a cult. Right? I mean, it just doesn't work that way. But it is tempting. You know, you just want to reach over, grab them by the shoulders, well, virtual shoulders where it's safe, where you're distanced, and say, what's wrong with you? I want to encourage everybody to support Noah's book. Andrew Torres wrote the foreword. It's called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. And with Noah's permission, I'm going to read just a small segment from the book, kind of give you a sample, and I will link to it in the description box. Now, talk to me about this audiobook. It's happening, right?
Yes. Yeah. The audiobook is in the process of being processed. It's a mess, but hopefully we're hoping to have it out by Christmas. So we should have it out long before this episode goes to air.
So who are you narrating?
Yes. And I narrate the part that I wrote, and then Andrew narrates the foreword.
I was going to say that would be like a crime against humanity if you didn't narrate your own stuff. Like, I don't know about you, but when I go in and do an audiobook, I know how I want it read. Like, the control freak in me couldn't subcontract it out to somebody else, right? Do you feel that when you go into the studio? Like, I know where the emphasis is. I know how I want to read it, right?
I don't know. Like, honestly, Seth, if I had your voice, maybe I would feel that way. But honestly, like, the whole time I was doing it, I was like, I wish Seth was reading.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Don't even start with me. No illusions. You're a good man. I'm going to put that link in the description box. Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. All my best to you and your family and in your work. Be safe out there. We'll talk soon, okay?
Sounds great, man. Thanks.
All right, I'm going to read you part of Noah's book. Let's take a short break. I'll be right back, and we will do that very thing. Hang on. With the permission of the author, let me read to you from the new book from No Illusions, Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith. Chapter 4 is called A Prophet to Lead Them. And he starts with a quote from a pastor or ministry. It says, "It is our belief that this ministry is called to serve people globally, to literally change the world according to the Great Commission. And our infrastructure and operational plan reflect the worldwide nature of that assignment. Our pastors share the gospel of Jesus more than 300 times per year, in churches, arenas, venues, convention centers, stadiums, and other facilities across the entire planet, and are committed to aggressive travel schedules that cannot be fulfilled via any other means other than private aircraft." That's a quote from Creflo Dollar Ministries' website. And the chapter begins, "When asked why they would not simply move their services online, religious leaders had a bevy of ready responses. They must lay hands on their congregants. Baptism cannot be done through Skype. Communion cannot be given on a Zoom call. The Lord's message requires a personal touch that cannot be obtained through any artificial means." Far less frequent was the admission that people simply were not attending online services. A poll by the American Enterprise Institute taken in late March, at a time when almost 90% of churches had suspended in-person activities, showed that only 28% of Americans attended a remote worship service. The number that normally report weekly church attendance is considerably higher. According to Pew's most recent religious landscape study, it's typically 36%. In an interview with the Washington Examiner, researcher Daniel Cox explained, "Many people reported that the feeling of community that comes with church is irreplaceable in an online setting. Social pressures to go to church, too, is harder to enforce when fellow congregants cannot see who is and who isn't watching streamed services." These explanations are as obvious as they are damning. To admit that people go to church for camaraderie rather than communion with the Almighty is dangerously close to conceding that one could get all the same benefits from a well-attended astronomy club without paying 10% of one's income or tacitly endorsing homophobia. To admit that people go to church because of peer pressure too starkly reveals the similarities between the standard business model of churches and drug dealers. And so, to whatever degree possible, church leaders obscure the profit motive and offer up some theological excuse instead. Of course, it's possible that many, most, or even all of these preachers are genuine in their ecclesiastical pretexts and honestly believe that continuing on a business model that has been proven to be more profitable also serves a metaphysical purpose. I'm no more capable of burrowing into their inner thoughts and discovering their true motivations than anyone else. All we have available are their words and their actions. But very often, that is all an objective mind needs to reach a conclusion. Take the example of the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Lithonia, Georgia. When senior pastor Jamal Bryant took over the church in 2018, his inaugural sermon promised renewal. Quote, "No matter what pit they try to throw us in, God always throws us a trampoline for us to be able to bounce back." Their new pastor's inability to think of a more sensible metaphorical aid for God to offer a person in a pit was the least of the church's concerns. The church was founded by homophobic televangelist Eddie Long, who excelled at growing the church's congregation, but not at managing its finances. His exorbitant salary led to a 3-year Senate investigation regarding the legitimacy of the church's tax-exempt status. And predictably, upon his death from cancer in 2017, it was revealed he had left his church with debts totaling around $30 million. Bryant was tasked with turning the church's finances around, and in coronavirus, he saw an opportunity. At the end of March 2020,
his church announced that it would be serving its community by turning its parking lot into a mobile health ministry and offering drive-through testing for people that feared they might be carrying the novel coronavirus at the heart of this epidemic. In all, New Birth Missionary Baptist intended to test 1,000 residents in the Atlanta suburb over a two-day period at $150 per person. The plans were hastily scrapped when outraged voices online pointed out that charging people for medical testing during a pandemic is an activity normally reserved for James Bond villains. The act was made even more heinous as Bryant had made it clear that his target was low-income residents. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's original write-up, Bryant said there are so many people of color living on the margins without adequate access to health services or little to no health issues that this was the right thing to do. When it comes to testing, these people are, quote, pretty low on the totem pole. Of course, one might defend Bryant by pointing out that people who gave him money would have at least wound up with the coronavirus test, which is more than most churches would offer for the same amount. Many preachers were simply thrilled to learn that so many of their gullible clients were about to receive a $1,200 windfall. And the book's referring to the government payout or the stimulus to help people during the pandemic. Pastor Tony Spell instituted what he called the Pastor Spell Stimulus Challenge, in which he encouraged his social media followers to give their entire $1,200 stimulus check to a pastor. He didn't name himself, of course. He simply advocated that you give the money to any pastor, provided they're evangelical and, for reasons left unexplained, North American. Pastor and spiritual advisor to the president, Paula White, was less subtle in her request. If a graph was constructed to measure how frightened secular Americans should be of every religious leader in the nation, where the y-axis represented how extreme and damaging their message was, and the x-axis represented their relative proximity to power, Paula White would rank among the most terrifying extremists in the country. A prosperity gospel televangelist, White made her fortune promising visions from God in exchange for donations to her ministry. Hers, like Eddie Long's, was among the ministries under the microscope by Republican Senator Chuck Grassley for allegations of financial mismanagement in the late 2000s. Unsurprisingly, Paula White refused to cooperate with the investigation. When White was announced, along with five other ministers, as part of Donald Trump's inauguration, some of the harshest criticisms came from within the Christian community. Southern Baptist leader Russell Moore tweeted, "Paula White is a charlatan and recognized as a heretic by every Orthodox Christian of whatever tribe." The denunciations eventually reached such a fever pitch that White felt the need to go on CNN and defend herself against charges of heresy, apostasy, adultery, charlatanism, and drug addiction. But bolstered by her longtime personal relationship with Donald Trump and her pretend doctorate, White became a key advisor to the president in the Office of Public Liaison, where she is tasked with advising the administration's Faith and Opportunity Initiative. Given the extraordinary profit margin on visions of God and the lax standards of this White House in terms of conflicts of interest, White felt no obligation to divest from her megachurch to take on this role. And thus, a key advisor to the president has a day job wherein people hand her money for no tangible exchange in goods or services. Unsurprisingly, White treated the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic as a boon. On March 17th, she hosted a half-hour Facebook prayer session, wherein she reassured concerned Americans that the Bible can help them through the trying times ahead, especially if they gave her money. Quote, "Churches do so much. not just from a humanitarian standpoint, but the greatest thing we do is bring spiritual truths that transform. What we do as ministers of the gospel is so vitally important because every single day we are a hospital to the sick. Not necessarily the physically sick, although we help take care of that. Many churches have health centers, etc., but we are a hospital for those who are soul sick, those who are spiritually sick, because we bring forth the Word of God, and we bring forth truth that gets deep down in your soul in a way you think and feel about things. Maybe you'd like to sow a $91 seed. And that's just putting your faith with Psalm 91, or maybe $9, or whatever God tells you to do. Don't forget, now is not the time to abandon your covenant with God. It's a time that you go deeper. Stand with your pastor. 2 days later, Paula White once again addressed her followers at a church service, giddy with excitement. Not only were electric companies allowing payments to be deferred, but even the IRS was extending the normal tax deadline by several months. Apparently, Paula White's ministry lacks the compassion and beneficence that the IRS is known for, as she made it clear that they still needed your money. We have to pay insurance. Our insurance is like $5,100 here, and it's like, that's a lot of money, you know? And so I always say, we're a smaller ministry, but we have a big impact. 2 days after that request, U.S. initial jobless claims rose from 282,000 to 3,283,000. And he gets into a segment here in the book I'm going to skip past, where he talks about a specific group of ultra-Orthodox Jews who were pitched an amulet that was supposed to prevent or even cure COVID-19, and people were paying obscene amounts of money for it. Then I skip down, and he says, ultra-Orthodox enclaves in semi-theocratic nations don't have a monopoly on religious cures for COVID-19. The Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing, or G2C, is a Florida church that encourages the faithful to ensure their health by drinking bleach. Even before Donald Trump's now infamous conjecture that injections of disinfectant might be used to clean the lungs of COVID-19 patients, the G2C was promoting nearly that exact treatment for diseases ranging from Alzheimer's to multiple sclerosis. The specific product they promote is called Miracle Mineral Solution, or MMS. It is an industrial bleach that has been embraced by some wings of the alternative medicine movement as a panacea. This belief is at least widespread enough that the FDA felt the need to issue a nationwide warning against drinking industrial bleach that begins with the words, "If you're drinking Miracle or Master Mineral Solution or other sodium chloride products, stop now." It goes on to warn, quote, "When mixed according to package directions, the ingredients become a strong chemical that is used as bleach. Some distributors are making false and dangerous claims that Miracle Mineral Supplement mixed with citric acid is an antimicrobial, antiviral, and antibacterial liquid that is a remedy for autism, cancer, HIV/AIDS, hepatitis, flu, and other conditions. But the FDA is not aware of any research showing that these products are safe or effective for treating any illness. Using these products may cause you to delay other treatments that have been shown to be safe and effective. The bottom line, sodium chloride products are dangerous, and you and your family should not use them. MMS consumers are drinking bleach." Of course, by presenting the product as a sacrament and the promoter as a church, the G2C has somewhat tied the FDA's hands. They can wave their hands above their heads and scream, "Drinking bleach can kill you, and even if it doesn't, it's still drinking bleach." But they can't directly prevent G2C from suggesting otherwise.
That's not to say that the federal government is entirely powerless. When G2C specifically claimed that MMS could treat and prevent coronavirus, federal prosecutors stepped in, pointed out that all MMS prevents is hydration, and convinced a judge in Florida to order a halt to at least that end of their sales pitch. But the folks at G2C weren't the only religious leaders who discovered that the miracle cure-all they were already promoting also treated COVID-19. People who grew up before the 80s will remember Jim Baker as the host of the PTL Club, or Praise the Lord Club, and the man who sat next to Tammy Faye Baker's eyelashes on television. Baker skyrocketed into national notoriety when it emerged he was paying hush money to Church Secretary Jessica Hahn to keep quiet about an alleged rape. While this scandal would be enough to force Baker into resigning from the ministry in disgrace, this was only the initial descent in his fall from grace. After a 16-month federal grand jury probe, Baker was indicted on 8 counts of mail fraud, 15 counts of wire fraud, and 1 count of conspiracy. He would later be convicted on all charges. He would ultimately serve 5 years in prison before returning to the incredibly forgiving world of televangelism. Despite still having that fresh, new fraud conviction smell, he was welcomed back into the fold, finding a ready bevy of accomplices as he settled back into the trade of terrifying the elderly with lies. His new program, The Jim Baker Show, was focused on the looming apocalypse and the need for a long-term supply of freeze-dried vittles that would surely accompany it. Lucky for the viewer, Baker also sold giant buckets of apocalypse food. And from that point, the book goes further into Jim Baker and his hawking of COVID-19 cures. He still mixes a lot of this with apocalyptic language, but that's just a sampling from the wonderful new book by No Illusions. It's called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic. It's well written, it's well defended, it's wildly entertaining, and it is simply spot on. The link to purchase the book in the description box of this broadcast. And as Noah said, the audiobook should release in the coming weeks. I know that Audible has had more than its share of production delays. They're saying it's because of COVID. Normally, it takes 2 weeks from submission to get an audiobook out. And lately, I think the production period has gone up to like up to 3 months from submission to getting it out. And I'm sure he's frustrated, but it's coming. The link is in the description box. Thanks to Noah for being part of the show. Thanks to you for being a part of the family. Be safe out there. I'll see you back here next time.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.